Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Ellen Brown. I always want to mention Ellen's books. Ellen just dazzled me, some years ago when I first read Web of Death. Just a magnificent book. If listeners have, I've mentioned so many times on this program, if listeners haven't read Web of Death, you just gotta get a copy and read it, because it's a primer on the way the death system works in America. And some months ago, Ellen came out with a sequel to Web of Debt, and she calls it The Public Bank Solution, From Austerity to Prosperity. And both of these books are just mandatory reading. Again, if you want to know how the money system in America works, how it steals from us and gives to the big boys, you know who, you got to read Ellen's books, and you know how it works, how we're literally robbed, and you'll get some idea of what we might do to fight back. Certainly, public banking is the obvious solution, and the only way it'll ever happen in America is if enough people get behind the idea and they demand it. In other words, people power. When there's enough people power, the impossible becomes the possible. It's happened many times in American history. It's happened remarkably a few times on major issues, lots of times on lesser ones, but it takes people power, nonviolent muscle, to get behind big issues. If you think you're going to vote for change, you're living in a dream world. Throwing out bums for new ones, all that gets you are new bums. They're all bums. I can't think of a single person in the Congress, 535 of them, who I would not call a bum. I can't think of any. Occasionally in the past, there have been some wonderful people in the Congress, Cynthia McKinney for one. Cynthia has been on this program a couple of times, and I always look forward to having her back. And Cynthia is a valued contributor to a book that will be coming out, I'm guessing around mid-year. It's on the Ukraine situation, and it's called Flashpoint in Ukraine, U.S. Drive for Hegemony Risks World War III. Wonderful contributors to the book, extraordinary people, distinguished figures. I'm the editor. I didn't want to be the editor, but I was asked to serve in that capacity. I wanted to contribute to the book, which I'm doing. And I've also got the double duty of being the editor, lining up and writing herd on the other contributors. My God, a pygmy like me writing on giants like the people contributing to this book. I mean, they really are giants, magnificent people. I've gotten in a number of their contributions, their chapters, some wonderful material, absolutely must reading to find out what's going on in Ukraine, what's the real story in Ukraine, why does it matter, and what's likely going forward. I call it, without exaggeration, the major geopolitical issue in the post-World War II era. There is nothing that compares to its importance, and that's no exaggeration. You'd never believe it listening to the major media, the scoundrel media, but it absolutely is. And I fear very, very much that we might be on a fast track toward a major confrontation. Yeah, it'll be a conflagration, all right, but a major confrontation with Russia. Never happened during the Cold War. Never was I worried. I'm scared to death today. Ellen, you got a new article, and before we jump into it, let me just clear my throat. Oh, you get a frog in there sometimes, and you just got to get that thing out. I think
yeah,
I'm okay.
Yeah, I've been doing that too lately.
And it's not January and February anymore. You had it easy in California, except for those earthquakes. Did you feel the earthquake, the recent one in the L.A. area?
Yeah, definitely. You know, we hadn't had earthquakes for 10 years. And then all of a sudden we started having little ones, which makes me highly suspicious. But
of a possible big one. When was it, 1989, that there was a big one? Or maybe that was San Francisco. I think that was San Francisco, a fairly big one.
I think it was in 92 or 93, something like that.
Oh, L.A. was
hit. Collapsed the bridge right here near where I live and killed some people. Yeah, but these are little ones, but we never used to feel them at all. I mean, nothing for ages, and then all of a sudden they've started up again. So,
well, Ellen, I'll never forget.
I suspect HARP and all those things.
Oh, indeed. They're very scary. I very well remember the one earthquake I went through. I was living with my family in San Diego, and we went through a mini, and it was during the workday. I was in my office on the 12th floor of a building. did it start shaking? I mean, it was only about a 3.5 or 4, so really, really very minor damage. But I had two phones. I was on one line, and my wife called me on the other line. I had two phones to my ears, and really what I wanted to do was put both phones down and duck under the desk. I didn't know what to do. I mean, it was very scary, even that mild. Of course, the higher up you are, I guess the more shaking you would feel. But I would dread the thought of going through one that was really a double that size. Just absolute horrors, because you literally feel helpless. Is the ceiling going to come down on you? Is something awful going to happen? What are you going to do? You can't get on an elevator. That's the worst thing to do. So it's a very scary thing. No earthquakes in Chicago, Ellen. Tornadoes in the outskirts. Some awful weather like we had this winter. You had mild weather. We had the coldest Chicago winter in my memory. I've been here since the 1960s, late 1960s. It was pretty bad, but now it's April, so it's a lot better. I want to jump into your article, but could we get into an important Supreme Court decision yesterday? And I've got an article all written. I wrote it yesterday, but I've been writing on so much I couldn't get it out today. It's going to have to wait till tomorrow. I hope I can get it out tomorrow. But I called it Supreme Court Rules for Big Money. Basically, the Supreme Court ruled. It was a follow-up ruling to the 2010 Citizens United ruling that also ruled for big money. You know the way the deal goes. $1 equals one vote. Well, they simply extended Citizen United and made it even more outrageous than Citizen United is, where basically the big boys with the deep pockets can spend. Well, I'll give you one statistic. I have my article up, but I'm not looking at the section. I think it was something like 589, let's call it nearly 600 major donors in America contributed during the 2012 presidential cycle or electoral cycle, which was presidential and congressional, and of course state and local as well. $3.1 billion, that's the figure. $3.1 billion, less than 600 major contributors. Well, you could take 6 million little people like us, Ellen, and my God, you'd get a minute fraction of that amount, too little to matter, really.
Yeah. Well, even this revision, I mean, before the revision, the limit for what big money could spend was way more than we little people can match. I'm running for California State Treasurer right now, and no way. I mean, no way to get up to where they are.
Oh, there's no way in the world. And to me, the only way to make, the first way to make politics legitimate, politics in America are absolute shams, illegitimate. As long as big money controls the process that Americans get, as Greg Palast said long ago when he wrote a book about it sitting on my shelf, Americans get the best democracy money can buy, and that's what it is. As long as big money buys the results, there's no democracy.
Right. My only hope is that if you have a good idea, now we have social media and the internet, and I get articles out, of course, but if you have an idea that catches on, it seems to me that you could capture, well, in my particular case, I'm running against John Chang, who is the current controller, like virtually impossible to beat, but also a Republican who's quite old and doesn't have his own website for the campaign. So, you know, he's not really pushing, but I understand that just because he's a Republican, he's liable to get 30% of the vote because many people just vote the party line. But anyway, it seems to me public banking obviously is my thing that I'm hoping to get out there. And if we can capture the public imagination, like with videos, I'm trying to make some short videos that make it very clear what we're talking about and why that's a good idea. I saw a TED talk on it included different examples, but the one I remember is the Wright brothers, who had no money to speak of, but they had the best model. And the man with lots of money but not such a good model lost out, and it was the Wright brothers who managed to capture the airplane business. So that's my hope. In this new modern age of the internet, we've seen what can be done in foreign countries with the social media to mobilize the people. I mean, some of that might be color revolutions, but anyway.
Oh, indeed so. I mean, things can be used responsibly, and the Wright brothers is a wonderful example, Ellen. I don't know the history of how they got off the ground and so on, but of course everybody knows who the Wright brothers were, and of course aviation began with their work, very important stuff. So even if you don't have money, if things are done responsibly, then big things can be accomplished, and we certainly need them now. It seems as though as we advance in history, Ellen, and I write about so many different topics, mostly geopolitical ones and major domestic issues, it seems in my lifetime, that goes back a fair ways, things have literally gotten worse and worse through the years, and it's incredible just how exponentially worse things got in the post-9/11 era. They were pretty bad before that. It seemed as though every president was worse than the previous one. You could go back to Franklin Roosevelt. Truman was worse than Roosevelt. My God, Korea. Eisenhower certainly was not entirely benign, not by any means. My God, we got the first ever CIA coup against the Iranian democratic leader, Mohammad Mossadegh. We had the Guatemalan government overthrown a year later, Iran 1953, Guatemala 1954. We had the beginning of the Vietnam War. It wasn't called a war then, and it wasn't a war, but sending advisors and so on, you know, U.S. military people to Southeast Asia. That was under Eisenhower. He left in 1960. You know, the military-industrial complex talk. Well, big talk, no action. Lovely talk. I've quoted from that talk so many times, Ellen. I mean, I'd certainly take Eisenhower to the people running things today. It would be a great improvement. And if you get a guy like that, he knew what war was all about. It certainly isn't any fun and games. And the people who fight the wars today, Ellen, like the Cheneys and the Bushes and the Obamas, they don't know squat about wars. I'd like to see them in a war sometime. I'd like to see them have their kids in a war sometimes on the front lines. People have a different attitude about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought that with Hillary when she said that after Gaddafi was killed and she triumphantly said, "We came, we saw, he died," and she sort of laughed. I mean, it was so undiplomatic, which makes you think that she only is listening. She doesn't have time to read, like, to know what's really going on in the world. She's only listening to advisors who are giving her bad information. Because surely, if you knew that there are people in Libya, like most of the people, who actually supported Gaddafi, and Gaddafi actually did some rather remarkable things for the country and for, he was starting to mobilize Africa, and that was probably the reason they had to go after him. But just the insensitivity suggests to me that they're so caught up in politics that they don't have time to, like, see what's really going on.
Well, that's exactly right, Ellen. As far as I remember those words from Hillary Clinton, seeing a clip on television a few times, out of the mouth of a war criminal, a hideous comment like that, and indeed Gaddafi was murdered. We never did get a full accounting of the body, Ellen, so there's not 100% confirmation that whoever was killed was Gaddafi. I mean, we never saw the body. We saw what could have been a double. No DNA, buried, I think, in an unmarked grave, who knows where, wherever the body was buried. You know, just like bin Laden. Well, bin Laden was not killed by Obama. That's one of the great hoaxes of our times. Obama, Obama didn't kill Osama.
Yeah, he was probably long dead.
Oh, well, the New York Times reported 6 months after he died in December 2001, and I quoted verbatim from the New York Times that he died a natural death. He died in Afghanistan. No, I'm sorry, it was either Afghanistan or, no, I think it was at a Pakistani hospital. It might have been in Rawalpindi, I forget exactly. But he died a natural death. He was a very ill man, kidneys, other diseases, other problems, and he died naturally, 2001, just a few months after 9/11, and he had nothing, zero, to do with 9/11, and all this stuff, pinning the blame on him, you know, one of many, many big lies. Of course, 9/11 is the big lie of our time. I would call it the big lie, maybe, of all times. Well, Hitler had a few of his own, but certainly this is the biggest one in U.S. history by far. And
mm-hmm. Looking at the economy at that time, that was when they totally deregulated the banks and allowed them to do these outrageous things that got us into the securitization disaster of 2008. So nobody's really looking. Like, all the attention is on, I mean, I'm sure 9/11 didn't happen for that reason, but our attention is always focused on these gigantic, probably man-created catastrophes, and we're not looking at how they're actually enslaving us, taking away our rights and our livelihoods and our homes.
Oh, that's exactly right, Ellen.
That's what I've been writing about.
Oh, exactly. And I've written about that, too, and it was in one of my books. I think it was in How Wall Street Fleeces America. But at the very end of the Clinton administration, either the end of 1999 or the beginning of 2000, just before he left office, within a couple of 3 weeks or so of when he left office, a passage of the abolishing Glass-Steagall, letting investment banks combine with ordinary commercial banks and insurance companies, you know, creating these mega banking institutions that literally that Wall Street fleece America, and the Commodity Futures Modernization Act that legalized the derivative scam. I mean, just outrageous stuff. So it wasn't George Bush who did this stuff. It was Bill Clinton. I wonder how many listeners know that. And you can look it up and see the dates.
Well, and again, the attention was deflected by the Clinton scandals, so nobody's really paying attention to what's
exactly
going on in there. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Well, all of this stuff goes on. And, of course, post 9/11, things just accelerated so rapidly to the downside. I mean, multiple wars, they still rage. I don't know what will happen supposedly at the end of this year, Ellen, when U.S. forces theoretically are supposed to leave Afghanistan. Well, they all won't leave. There'll be a fair number left. There'll be some kind of a deal struck to keep so many thousands there. There are mega bases, city-sized mega bases that America does not give up. They maintain them in Iraq. I don't know how many U.S. forces are still sitting on these bases. They control the airspace of these countries, and they turn both of these countries and Libya and now Syria into absolutely out-of-control cauldrons of violence where the sitting government has no control at all over anything going on. Well, in Syria, certainly they do. The Assad government is still very much running Syria, but fighting a tremendous battle against these imported death squads that are coming in, supported, funded, trained by U.S. special forces, by CIA elements, lots of Saudi money involved, lots of Qatari money involved, Israel is involved. This war still is raging, and Syria doing an admirable job getting rid of a lot of these people, but they keep pouring in. I mean, they're like crabgrass. They're like a disease. No matter how many you get rid of, more come in to take their place. And I've written so much about this. All the supposed chemical weapons attacks, Alan, were carried out by these death squad invaders. Not a single one was carried out by the Syrian government, and that's a clear, provable fact, but you'd never know it in the major media. And a new one. I put out an article this morning about another planned false flag attack, chemical weapons attack against the Syrian government. And a couple of days ago, I put out an article, a phone call that there was hacked into and leaked and recorded with four Turkish officials planning a false flag attack from Turkish territory in Syria. Turkey, I didn't know this, or if I knew it, I forgot it. Turkey has its own territory inside Syria, a patch of ground, and they were going to fire off rockets onto that territory and fire off more rockets from inside Syria onto Turkish territory and blame it on Syria as an attack, as a pretext to invoke NATO's so-called Article 5, which states that an attack on one NATO member, 28 of them, obligates the other 27 to join in the defense of that one country. In other words, it's a pretext for Libya 2.0. Well, the plot was foiled. We'll wait for the next plot. But so far, Syria is holding up, and Iran's turn awaits. I say that all the time. Regime change, that's the dirty game. Get rid of the legitimate governments, the independent ones, replace them with pro-Western puppet ones, and Washington is the chief mischief maker, no question. Domestically and overseas, Ellen.
Agreed.
it's hard disputing that. I mean, the evidence there is so plain in black and white that anybody can do the research you do on the domestic scene, talking about the big financial issues and the stuff that I do. It could either be domestic or geopolitical. I mean, just horrible stuff. And then you got big money running everything. I always talk about moneyed interests running America, and it's true with what you write about, Ellen, and it's true with the way we're ripped off by moneyed interests, so they get it all, and we're left holding the bag. Let's talk about your new article, bail-ins. Gee, it's been a while, but I wrote about bail-ins last year.
Yeah, well, the European Union has come out with a new, they've finally virtually passed their banking union, which requires all the EU countries or the Eurozone countries to join together to bail out any one of these 130 big banks that are considered too big to fail. But the provisions include not just bail out, but bail in. So the first thing they will do is go after the creditors' money, and the creditors include the depositors. Now, the language of the bill makes it sound like they're only talking about the uninsured depositors, but they never put the third part of this plan into place. It was supposed to be a three-pronged plan, and the third plan was deposit insurance that would be collectively done by all the Eurozone countries. And they haven't agreed to that. Germany doesn't want to agree to bail out all the depositors across the Eurozone, which is probably what would happen. So the deposit insurance is only what the individual country has, and they're very insufficient for a major bust like we had in 2008. The U.S. FDIC insurance only covers less than 2% of deposits. So if you had something really major that cost like $700 billion, like the 2008 bailout did, there's definitely, the FDIC fund only has $32 billion in it, so there's clearly not enough to bail out all the depositors. So you're still vulnerable as a depositor in the Eurozone, but you're also then vulnerable as a taxpayer, because the part that isn't paid by the depositors will come out of this fund that is collectively put together by the Eurozone countries. So that's what I was writing about, and the reason they've rushed this through, even though it's arguably illegal under their own EU parliamentary rules, is that that the banks are in really bad shape, and they're not revealing how bad until after they get this liability locked in place, so that they know who's going to pay for it once they reveal. They've done these assessments earlier that were stress tests that were just sort of skimmed over the surface, but they've agreed to do really serious, to take a really serious look at the books of these banks, but not until the banking union is in place. So now it's in place. Apparently they're not worried about the deposit insurance. The other two parts are in place. So you can just assume that once it's revealed what bad shape these banks are in, that then the investors will flee, the bank will come down, and there'll just be a mass collapse, and it'll all be imposed on the voters, I mean the taxpayers and the depositors. And so quite shocking.
It really is shocking, and a bail-in means that your supposedly FDIC-insured money in your bank account can literally be swiped from you and you'll lose it. And Ellen, I remember in one of your articles on this topic last year, you explained, and in one of my articles, I quoted your explanation that when you put your money in a bank account, whether it's a checking account, a money market account, a savings account, it's no longer yours. It belongs to the bank.
Right. Most people think that the bank puts it in a little box somewhere and it's got their name on it and it's there to be withdrawn. But in fact, it becomes money of the banks, and the depositor now has an IOU. So you're now a creditor of the bank. The bank is your debtor. So they can then spend the money as they like. That's what the whole Glass-Steagall Commodities Futures, whatever it was, Act was all about, that they can now take your deposit money and buy well, the thing they were doing with securitization was they would take the depositor money and buy mortgage-backed securities with it, and then they can use those mortgage-backed securities as collateral in the repo market, which means they can take out very cheap loans and use those very cheap loans to invest in whatever they want. They can buy assets of all sorts. That's why they can manipulate the gold market and the oil market, and they're buying up things like airports and seaways and things that are, I don't know about seaways, anyway, airports I saw. So they're buying up real things, like real estate type things, with loans created from our deposits, which technically now belong to the bank, and they owe us the money, but we didn't know that. We didn't know we were making a loan to the bank. We thought we put it there for safekeeping. It's anything but safe. It could go down. In fact, I think that's what I'm going to write about next. I wrote about eminent domain in my previous article, or previous but one, where in Richmond, California, Gail McLaughlin, who's the Green Party mayor of Richmond, is planning to take underwater mortgages by eminent domain and then renegotiate them on behalf of the homeowners. Underwater mortgages are ones where substantially more is owed on the mortgage than the house is worth, and something like half the mortgages in Richmond are in that situation, and it's ruining property values, it's ruining their tax base. So it's definitely in the public interest to do that. But as soon as they announced that, then some big banks filed a lawsuit saying that this was unconstitutional, taking a private property without due process, and breach of contract. So the judge said it was premature because they hadn't actually done it yet. I think they're lacking one vote on the council. But so what I wrote about was a way they could beat that argument is to say, well, we're taking properties, or anyone that can show clear title to the property will renegotiate, will pay fair market value and do the right thing. And the banks won't be able to show clear title, and neither will the trusts, the real estate trusts that supposedly hold these properties, because they didn't actually deliver. It's all the robo-signing scam, where virtually all of them, they didn't deliver the mortgage back to the trust within the period required in the pooling and servicing agreements of the trust, which would be like within 6 weeks of closing, like way back in 2004 or 2005 or something. And why? So the issue I would like to write on now is, why didn't they transfer those mortgages on time? It's because the mortgages are left in blank, so they're fungible and they can be traded on the repo market. In other words, repo is a purchase and sale. Sorry, the gardeners are outside. Purchase and sale. And you can't sell something if it's owned by a trust. So that's why they need this. Sorry, we've got gardeners outside. Anyway, so that's what I'd like to write out. That the whole system is totally fraudulent. It's all based on a fraud. And the fraud is that they're using our bits of real estate, just like in fractional reserve lending, where they're doing rehypothecations, like they're borrowing against this collateral several times over, and they don't even own the collateral, or they didn't own the deposits that they used to buy the collateral. So really, technically, the entire real estate, or well, whatever, over half the mortgage market, which is in the name of MERS and in these securitizations, is fraudulent and should be taken by eminent domain by the government. Somebody wrote to me and said, well, there's no way they'll ever, declare this illegal or declare that the banks or the trust don't own the properties, because that would bring down the whole mortgage market. But I think it would restructure the whole mortgage market. You need to do like they did in the 1930s, where the homeowners, the HOLC, Homeowners Loan Corporation, I guess, where they did basically take underwater bankrupt mortgages by eminent domain, and or they took them and renegotiated them and got the homeowners back on their feet and did the fair thing. So we actually even have precedent for it. I think I'm almost turning into a Georgist, the idea that the land belongs to to the people collectively, and then you renegotiate, or you negotiate from there.
What's going on now, Ellen, especially since the meltdown in 2008, still going on today? There's a Main Street depression with a D, and I always make it a capital D. There's a depression going on in America. You'd never know it from, you know, the GDP numbers and all the manipulated, all the numbers are manipulated coming out of Washington, whether it's commerce, labor, whatever. They're all manipulated. Inflation is three times as high as the original, is the official figure. GDP is not the number reported. So many of the other numbers are completely corrupted, including the jobs reports every month, where even the jobs that are created are rotten ones that 40 years ago or 50 years ago, when I was a working guy, or when I was coming out of school at the end of the 1950s, February of 1960 to be exact, I mean, there were wonderful jobs available then, even in soft economic periods, which was exactly the situation I faced when I came out. Not really a recession, but it was kind of soft as compared to more robust times a year or so earlier and that followed later in the 60s. I had no trouble getting a job. I took one day off after I graduated. I thought I'd just kind of exhale, and then I went to work. I had to go to work. I wanted to go to work. I needed the money. I had to pay bills, and I didn't want to sit around. So 24 hours I relaxed. I went right to work, and that's what I did for the rest of my working life, including in small family business for most of it. And it was a different world back then, but it was like we crossed a very ugly Rubicon at the end of the 1990s, and everything absolutely went to pot, where things have just descended really into a black hole of the most abysmal stuff affecting ordinary people, literally ripped off ordinary people, and poverty is extremely high. I remember quoting from a New York Times story, it goes back a few years, based on Census Bureau data, that half the households in America are either impoverished or bordering on it. And the census definition of poverty is something like four decades old. It is so out of date. It's meaningless. You know, something like $24,500 for a family of four in a city like Chicago. My God, I mean, you have a closet for a home. I don't know how you could survive in anything like that. You certainly couldn't afford health insurance. You couldn't afford a car. You probably couldn't afford to heat your home properly in wintertime. You couldn't afford a lot of things. Couldn't afford to pay college tuition. Couldn't afford all of this stuff, $24,500, to get by minimally in Chicago and have just an above-water, decent living standard, nothing luxurious. You'd need at least double that amount, maybe even more. It's awfully expensive in downtown Chicago where I live. And if you live in a city like New York or San Francisco, my God, Hawaii, Honolulu, my God, the cost of living is off the scale, extremely high. 24.5 in either of those cities, you'd starve to death. That's how bad things are, and nothing is done. Nobody wants to raise the minimum wage. Well, I personally despise a minimum wage. I want a living wage, a minimum wage that people need on any job to be able to live on, to survive on. You know, the liars claim it's a job destroyer.
Yeah, or I would like to see a living or a basic income guarantee that comes from the government,
yes,
which is something you could do in order to make up the gap between what consumers can afford to buy and our GDP. And you could do that without causing inflation. Everybody thinks it would be inflationary, but all you have to do is print the money or create it on the books of the Federal Reserve or, better yet, of the Treasury, do some trillion-dollar coins, issue the money, and pay them by credit card, don't do coins, let's say, or take the coin, put it in your bank account, and then you can issue credit cards for $10,000 for every family. And close the income gap, or the gap between GDP and income of the people. So you need to do that just to balance out the economy. I just did a PowerPoint for a presentation in Claremont, and so I was, you know, looking for all kinds of charts, and you see all these charts where it looks just like before 1929, where the disparity between rich and poor is so great. You can see by looking at the chart that the rich theirs has grown exponentially, and it can't keep going at that rate. Okay, there's no way. I mean, exponential curves just don't grow forever. They grow till they run out of their food source, and the food source is the debt of the people, and the people can only support so much debt, and then the whole thing collapses. And we're right at that point again. The charts look just like in 1929. In fact, they're worse. The disparity is worse today. So that will has to collapse. It's a Ponzi scheme that must must collapse. And the good news, it seems to me, is that just like in the 1930s, that's where you'll have to see radical change. People will suddenly wake up and say, all these things that seem like a good idea, like public banking, for example, but don't seem to get implemented when things really fall apart. And it's so obvious that these Wall Street banks are totally corrupt. Why are we banking with them? We need to set up our own banks. Then you'll have some real people power behind the push to change things, and then you might actually see some change. I don't know if we'll see it. I mean, you need a leader who's got the vision to do all that, and we certainly don't seem to have very many of those right now. I guess there are a couple that might possibly be propelled up there. So,
yeah, I certainly don't see any leaders with integrity and courage to do the right thing,
Ellen. I just heard Bernie Sanders. I guess he's running for president. he's got some good ideas.
Well, I must say, I soured on Bernie Sanders during the debate about Obamacare because he was the only senator, one against 99, who introduced a universal health care resolution in the Senate. He had no co-sponsors. He was all alone, and he lobbied for you guaranteed universal health care. And when it came to the vote on Obamacare, it was a time in the Senate where his vote mattered. Voting one way took the thing in one direction. Voting another way would have taken it in another direction. And he voted the wrong way. He supported Obamacare, this monstrosity that is getting more and more exposed to be shown for what it is, an absolute consumer ripoff, and he supported it. And because of that, I completely lost faith in Bernie Sanders, and I must say, Ellen, I want nothing to do with him.
Well, how about Elizabeth Warren?
She is only so-so. She's got some good points, but she doesn't go far enough. I mean, Obama appointed her, supported her. She never would have been supported if she didn't go along with a lot of stuff that the Obama administration puts out. She supports it.
How about Alan Grayson?
I know the name, and I haven't followed exactly what he's doing, but I must say, I can't think of anybody in the Congress who really is a profile of courage. There are no Cynthia McKinneys in the Congress today, none. Cynthia was absolutely magnificent. She was true blue all the way, but she's the exception that proves the rule. And when somebody good like that gets in, she was elected, she was defeated, she was elected again. They go after these people with big money, and they drive them out. In her case, they got a black Democrat to run against her in a primary. They heavily funded her. They stonewalled her on funding, and the other person beat her, and she was taken out of the Congress. But imagine if we had a Congress with a majority of people like Cynthia McKinney's in it. It would be a whole different world, Ellen.
Yeah, the trouble is it's controlled. So how do they get in there? Or they will get bumped out. So my whole thing is that we should work at the local level because that's where we actually still have some influence. Seems to me that things are sort of in lockdown mode in Washington, but at your state and local level. Well, so I'm running for state treasurer. California is the eighth largest economy in the world. We really should be our own country. I mean, we should definitely have our own bank, it seems to me. There's no reason that we should be dependent on these Wall Street banks, which have been caught in, 16 of the world's largest banks were caught in LIBOR rigging, which is the London Interbank Office rate, interest rate. So that involves something like, is it $400 trillion in interest rate swaps? So they're totally rigging a market collectively, which means they are a cartel. It should be a RICO action. It should be criminal liability. But as our attorney general has said, they're too big to prosecute because the whole system is a big house of cards or a big pyramid scheme, and if you pull out the little sticks holding the thing up, then the whole thing will collapse. That's what they're afraid of. So we have to just totally redo the system. But how do we do it? It seems to me that we probably have to wait for some crisis when people are ready for this. And so what I do in the meantime is just keep writing, and get some ideas out there. And then we could get some working models at the local level. We could get state-owned banks, city-owned banks. There's several cities that are now working on publicly owned banks. Nobody's really broken through and done it besides North Dakota. We have that amazing model. But globally, there are lots of models, and they work very well. And that's one thing we should do. I'm thinking in the meantime, several people have approached me about setting up a private bank that would... Its purpose would be to recycle, basically by crowdfunding, the people's money for things that would save the planet. You know, inventions that will clean the ocean, clean the air, make it so you can virtually feed yourself from your front lawn, that type of thing. Things that we need to save the environment that we all live in, and it's about to go down. I think that would be such a popular thing that if we could get that idea out there, people would buy. Well, one man was suggesting if people bought $1,000 shares, you know, one share for $1,000, lots of people would invest in that. I'd certainly invest in it in order, because we don't seem to be able to mobilize government very quickly, but we could mobilize that. We could get the money together to found a bank. In fact, there is one bank that's already on an Indian reservation, so it's sovereign, and it can pretty much do what it wants, and they're looking at something like that. So it would just be a matter of publicizing it. And so there are various possibilities. It seems to me there are lots of inventions out there that just need the money to be developed. Right now, they're literally suppressed. The big oil interests don't want anyone to know that there's such a thing as free energy, or, you know, that... whatever, zero-point energy or Tesla energy or various ways of getting energy that are more efficient than oil, but they need to be developed.
Helen, I think you're right on the mark on the strategy being to go local to begin with. And this was exactly what the Republican strategy was back in the late 1960s, early 1970s, when the Democrats really controlled Washington at the administration and congressional levels. And, of course, Nixon was elected in 1968, came in 1969 when... Lyndon Johnson, because of Vietnam, had to withdraw from the race. He had no support, so he had to drop out. And who was it who ran against Nixon? Hubert Humphrey against Nixon. But the strategy, it wasn't just the office of the presidency. The idea to gain power is you need to gain it, you know, throughout the roots of the system. That's exactly what the Republicans had. Of course, the big difference between them, Ellen, and us is they had big money backing them, so they could really do a lot of funding, throw some money power into many local elections, starting with local school boards and city councils and things like that, then working up to mayoralties and gubernatorialships and getting into the Congress. But it was a multi-year campaign to really take over government this way, and it worked wonderfully for them. And of course, now we really have a one-party state, don't have a two-party system, you know, two different names, basically one party, not a dime's worth of difference between them. Anybody who thinks it's not that way, again, living in a dream world. In a dream world, they agree on all the big issues. It's a very sick system, but the only way to defeat it is to really get after it on a local level, win the little stuff, and then work up from there. And that really is a marvelous strategy.
Yeah. I was just listening to Bernie Sanders, who you've decided you don't like, but it's saying that the second richest family is the Koch brothers, in the whole country, and they are bringing all this legislation to protect their interests. Like, how much money do you need? And he suggested that it's not really an economic issue or a political issue. It's a psychiatric issue. There's something wrong with this mentality that if you've got more money than 90% of the population, you need more, or you need to, you know, cut back on whatever, Social Security, and lower your taxes.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, after you have so many billions of dollars, and I don't know exactly how many billions the two Koch brothers have, but they're just massive billions. And, of course, the Walmart family, each of them...
they're number one, yeah.
Oh, well, I guess it's divided up among a number of members, so there's no one that, that rises to the top of the heat. But Bill Gates, number one in America, and Carlos Slim in Mexico, some other Latin American multi-billionaire many times over. Michael Bloomberg, some, the last Forbes, I have an article written about him I haven't gotten out yet. It's just sitting there. I've got time. He's going to be Harvard's commencement speaker at the end of May. Just outrageous. Outrageous. I mean, the guy's a crook. He's a crook. Mm-hmm. But it was even more outrageous. Well, it was just as outrageous last year. At Oprah Winfrey, another crook, as Harvard's commencement speaker. You know, I mean, not a legitimate commencement speaker in sight. And I wrote an article about past commencement speakers. You know, even Winston Churchill was at one time. Mine was Jack Kennedy. I mentioned that a number of times. But he gave a talk worth listening to. And the talks they give today, you're hearing big money talk. I don't know what the hell Oprah Winfrey has to say. She's got nothing to say I want to hear. And Bloomberg, he opens his mouth, it's the sound of money. Oh, it's a terrible system, Ellen. If we don't find a way to change it, it really is going to wreck us. What worries me most is the system. It's more than just stealing us blind. It's really driving us on the road to war and the possibility of a third global war. In other words, World War III. And the fact that we had two certainly does not mean it is out of the realm of possibility that we could have another one, World War III. Yeah. And what's going
on?
They
may be looking for another war just to conceal the fact, I mean, just to mobilize the people to fight, to conceal the fact that of what they're doing domestically to labor. They don't seem to need labor anymore. And the problem is that everybody wants to go into finance these days. Nobody wants to actually work. There's a book called Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and it says if you want to be a rich dad, giving your kids sound advice for how to make money, don't tell them to learn a profession. Don't tell them to learn labor or something that would produce something. Coach them to go into money-making money schemes, because that's the only way to make money. I mean, one of them grows linearly and the other grows exponentially. So you want the exponential growth type jobs, which is doesn't produce anything. It's a parasite on the economy. It's exploiting the economy, and it mathematically absolutely is not sustainable and must collapse. So we've got totally wrong values here these days.
We certainly do have wrong values, and I agree with you. And I remember your articles going back a number of years talking about a parasitic system. And you're right. I mean, this thing, the stock market, and the numbers coming out of Washington, the economic and financial numbers, I mean, we have an artificially supported system. It's non-sustainable. And, you know, you can keep this thing going longer than most people expect. But it's like a game of musical chairs, maybe. At some point, the music is going to stop. And at some point, there'll be one person. There'll be somebody left standing holding the bag. And except there won't be one person. It'll be the entire system that will come a cropper at some point, because they let this thing go so long. And I remember the late Bob Chapman, Ellen, who was a Wall Street insider at one time. He turned so strongly on the other side, passed away a couple of years ago. I think a couple of years ago, maybe next month or mid-year or so. And I miss him so much, because I look forward to his monthly commentaries on the state of the economy. And he said exactly the same thing, that, you know, they can keep this dirty game going longer than most people would imagine, but there's an end game to it, and the end game is very ugly, and the longer they keep it going, the greater the crash will be when it finally comes. And it's going to come, and it's going to hit ordinary people hardest, and I just dread the thought of what's going to happen when it finally does. But we have to simply puncture this balloon and get rid of it if we're ever going to have a chance to come back and have a sustainable system that really benefits benefits everyone. I'd like to see a nation, Ellen, as flawed as it was when I was getting out of school and going to work. There were opportunities for kids from nowhere. I came from basically an inner city neighborhood. I had nothing going for me, but school was cheap, and I had opportunities, and people like me could make the most of what they were able to do. And that doesn't exist today. We've got to get back to a system like that.
I agree. It's really horrible what they're doing to young people today. I've talked to a lot of really intelligent people that are either really struggling. I mean, they just don't have opportunities like we did. I went to Berkeley when tuition was free, and to UCLA Law School when tuition was $700 a year, and now it's $45,000 a year for an in-state student at UCLA Law School, which is a state school, state-supported school. So how can you possibly, I mean, even if you managed to come up with the $135,000 just for tuition, not counting room and board, you're going to have to immediately take a job at a high-powered firm, which means you're going to be working for the big corporations just to pay back your loan. And those jobs are hard to come by. So.
They're very hard to come by indeed. Ellen, we're getting near the end of the hour. What I wanted to do was cut a little bit short. I wanted to do a little housekeeping at the end. I've got 5 minutes to go. Let me do this. Let me wrap it up and thank you for coming on. I'll use the last 5 minutes to do some housekeeping. I'll get back to you by email when I go off here, and I look forward to having you back next month, Ellen.
Thanks.
It's an exhilarating. I'm sure my listeners feel the way I do. You certainly enlighten me every time you come on. It's a joy to have you. It's important stuff, everything that you discuss, and your financial articles, they're the best, Ellen. What else can I say?
Thanks, Stephen.
Thanks,
it's always
Ellen.
Great to talk to you.
We'll talk again next month. Okay. Let me just mention a couple of things. I am pre-recorded now on Thursdays and Fridays. My one live program is on Sundays. That's the same time as it always was, at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. My Thursday and Friday programs will be in my archives, hopefully shortly after the program ends, so listeners can go there and access all my programs just the way they used to. And I hope they will, and I hope they'll follow them. Let me mention one more thing important to me. I wrote about the fact a couple of days ago that a Israeli Arab citizen by the name of Marwan Dalal was petitioning Israel's Supreme Court about Israeli war crimes, obvious war crimes that took place in Lebanon in 2006, in Gaza in December 2008, January 2009, and in May 2010, attacking a humanitarian mission to Gaza, murdering in cold blood 9 Turkish national human rights activists. The evidence is overwhelming. War crimes, crimes against humanity. Well, the word came down today, to no surprise. The Israeli High Court is rubber stamped, and it ruled against Dalal. It will not hear the case. And the only information I have so far is it said, quote, the petitioner, meaning Dalal, didn't provide enough evidence to prove the connection between the respondents and the events that, as the petitioner sees them, could be called war crimes. This apparently was a unanimous verdict by the High Court Israeli judges. Well, in other words, what the court is saying is, war crimes are okay, and we support them, and we don't care what the law or anybody else says. As long as Israel wants to commit crimes of war and against humanity, it's okay with us. Let them go ahead and do it. And if anybody petitions us to act against them, we'll decline. And that's exactly what happened. So, Israeli war criminals are free to kill again. And indeed, they're taking full advantage every day. How many listeners know this? Every day, there are multiple violent incursions into Palestinian communities. Occasionally, there are deaths. There are lots of injuries. There are lots of arrests made. Everything that goes on is lawless, free societies wouldn't tolerate anything like this. But it's a daily occurrence in Israel, literally multiple times a day. If anybody asked me, I could cite the evidence chapter and verse. On average, maybe 60 to as many as 90 times a week this happens. Innocent people are literally terrorized, plus the wars that go on, plus the ones that are planned. So much to talk about. I look forward to another program tomorrow. My guest tomorrow, who's on with me? My guest, James Petras will be on. He has a new book. I review that in two parts. I put the first part out today. I'll put the second part out tomorrow. Jim will be on tomorrow, another marvelous guest, and we'll talk about his new book. We'll talk about other things on Jim's mind, and then I'll be back live on Sunday. I'll have Andrew Colin on. Andrew and Jim both are very valued contributors to the book that we're putting together on the Ukraine situation. And this morning I wrote another article in Ukraine. I've written many media critiques on it. And my article on Ukraine for tomorrow is called Reckless Russia Bashing Persists. The most outrageous lies persist about what Russia supposedly is doing, which is polar opposite what's going on. So in other words, Russia turns left, it's accused of turning right. Russia does an about-face, it's accused of marching forward. One big lie repeats after another. And the major media, the scoundrel media, keep picking this stuff up, quoting the official sources, marching in lockstep with belligerents. Russia has done nothing, zero, illegal with respect to the Ukraine situation. Russia honored the will of 96.7%. 96.77% of the Crimean people for reunification with Russia based on an 82% turnout. They couldn't do anything less. I'm out of time. Join us again. Tomorrow, archives, Sunday live. Make it a regular habit.